Our scripture reading for this morning is 1 Samuel 13, 1 through 15. 1 Samuel 13, 1 has puzzled translators for a long time. Different English translations render it according to their conclusions, as we'll see in just a moment when I read and you compare your translation to mine. Thankfully, we don't have to depend on any one translation to understand that over a decade has transpired between the time that Saul became king and this point in his kingship. Numerous other chronological factors play into this, such as the age of Jonathan, Saul's son. The major point is that a shift has taken place in Saul's life and kingship. Verses 8 through 15 bear this out. Please follow along with me as I read 1 Samuel 13, 1 through 15 from the NIV Bible. Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 42 years. Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel, 2,000 were with him at Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah in Benjamin. The rest of the men he sent back to their homes. Jonathan attacked the Philistine outpost at Geba, and the Philistines heard about it. Then Saul had a trumpet blown throughout the land and said, "Let the Hebrews hear." So all Israel heard the news. Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost, and now Israel has become a stench in the Philistines, to the Philistines. And the people were summoned to join Saul at Gilgal. The Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They went up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth Avon. When the men of Israel saw that their situation was critical and that their army was hard-pressed, they hid in caves and thickets among the rocks and in pits and cisterns. Some Hebrews even crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal. And Saul's men began to scatter. So he said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings." And Saul offered up the burnt offering. Just as he had finished making the offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. "What have you done?" asked Samuel. Saul replied, "When I saw that the men were scattering, and that you did not come at the set time, and the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favor.' So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering." "You acted foolishly," Samuel said. "You have not kept the command of the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people, because you have not kept the Lord's command." Then Samuel left Gilgal and went up to Gibeah in Benjamin. And Saul counted the men who were with him. They numbered about 600.
Gordon Weekly was a graduate of the Southern Baptist Seminary in, as they say down there, Louisville, Kentucky. In 1955, he accepted the call to become pastor of a home mission church in Charlotte, North Carolina. It was a group of 26 people with 8 acres of land. Over the next 13 years, Gordon led the church and watched it grow from 26 to 2,200. It's interesting to me, there was a book written about this a number of years ago, but recently when I looked online, I found the journal of one of the deacons of the church that gave the history of this as well. And this is what he wrote. "From appearances, it seemed that everything Gordon Weekly wanted, he got. And everything Providence Baptist wanted to do, it did. However, appearances can be misleading, especially at this time for Weekly. Early in his Providence ministry, Gordon had been introduced to a young Charlotte physician, and a special bond of friendship had developed between them. During lunch one afternoon in August of 1958, the physician asked Gordon how things were going. And his response was, things couldn't be better. Except, I've been feeling a little jittery lately. So following lunch, they walked back to the physician's office where the doctor wrote out two prescriptions for Gordon. The first, Gordon would take in the morning to relieve his jitteriness. The second, Gordon would take about a half hour before bedtime to help him sleep better. And the young physician assured Gordon that the drugs were safe and non-addictive. The writer adds this, something that a pharmacist today would disagree with. As the days turned into weeks, unrelenting pressures led him to take more and more of the two drugs. However, they didn't seem to impair his work. He strove to be a better pastor and caretaker for his church flock. Providence Baptist Church's membership continued to grow rapidly during the spring of 1959, and so did Gordon Weekly's need for more and more drugs. His addiction led to loss of weight because it was affecting his health. He eventually ended up resigning as the pastor, then in drug rehab. He lost his home, and then his wife, and then his children. He ended up homeless and living on the streets. You know, the path away from God is not just through drugs or alcohol. The path away from God can come through pride and self-sufficiency and fear of people. And that's the case of Saul, as we're going to look together at 1 Samuel chapters 13 and 14. Because in these two chapters, the Holy Spirit has directed the hand of Samuel to pen for us in a masterful way Saul's decline. Remember last week, from a changed man, God changed his heart. God chose him, and now we find out that he's a self-centered man, very self-centered. And the biblical historical account paints for us a powerful picture of how even a believer can walk away from God little by little over time and face consequences that are devastating. And so what we're going to do is we look at these two chapters and focus on certain verses in these chapters is consider together and group them around what I'd like to call seven downward spiral steps away from God. Or I've used the term backsliding, right? Christians, it is possible for Christians to backslide. So in the first four verses of 1 Samuel chapter 13, we're going to see how that backsliding begins or can begin with a subtle shift from dependence upon God to self. Now, it's interesting, Brother Duane read from the NIV, and the NIV translates verse 1, Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 42 years. Well, if you have a Bible like mine, you see that the word 30 is in italics, the word 40 is in italics, and so they're trying to figure out exactly what this verse says. In fact, the 1978 New American Standard translation reads like this, Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 32 years over Israel. Well, we know that's not true, and that's why in the 1995 translation update that I have here, they changed it. They flipped the numbers around. But the Hebrew text, for those of you who are in Praetorium, Jonathan, reads like this. And a word-for-word translation would go like this. When he was son of a year, Saul began to reign, and he reigned 2 years over Israel. Now, there are some very important facts for us to understand in terms of what the scriptures say about this. Thankfully, we're not dependent upon just this verse. But Acts chapter 13 and verse 21 says that Saul reigned for 40 years. So there's an established fact. Saul reigned for 40 years. And when you look at the rest of Kings and Chronicles, what you find out is that this follows the same kind of formula for dating the reigns of kings. So-and-so started to reign in this year of this king, and he reigned for this many years. And so that pattern, you can follow that through Kings and Chronicles. But there are other factors as well. Okay, I forgot I had this here first. Oh yeah, the timeline. So son of a year, but son of a year when? Son of a year in David's life. I mean, following that same pattern that we have in Kings and Chronicles, Samuel is actually dating the reign of Saul in terms of David's life. So son of a year in David's life is Saul in his reigning, and two more years after his one-year-old status, he reigned from the end of David's first year. And so when you look at this timeline, and you have one in your bulletin as well with your outline, you can see that from the time that Saul becomes king until David is born, that's a 10-year period right there. And now you've added another 1 to 3 years in terms of David's life. And so you come to the place where Saul now, according to verse 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 13, has been reigning for somewhere between 12 and 14 years. That's pretty clear. And if you say, well, I'm not so sure that's clear to me. All right, well, let me give you some more facts, okay? He reigned 40 years, Acts 13, 21. His fourth son, Ish-bosheth, was 40 years old when Saul died, according to 2 Samuel 2:10. So he had to have been born when Saul began to reign. And Jonathan, Saul's oldest son, had to be at least 20 here in this chapter, 1 Samuel chapter 13, because according to the law in Numbers chapter 1, verse 3, chapter 26, and verse 2, you couldn't serve in the military unless you were at least 20 years old. And so Jonathan at this point is probably maybe as old as 22 years old. And since he was born about 8 years before Saul became king in 1050, it squares with this chronology that we see in these chapters. It would make him, like I said, about 22 years old. And he would have been fighting alongside of Saul for about 2 years since he was able to join the military. So the conclusion, when you take all the factors into consideration, by the way, this is why we believe the Bible, the whole Bible, because we want to take into consideration all the facts that have to do with any particular point. And all of these factors fit together to tell us that verse 1 here is the 12th or 14th year of Saul's reign. Now, we actually have more than that. In verses 47 and 48 of chapter 14, we have this summary statement of what has happened in Saul's reign up to this point. And so when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, the kings of Zobah and the Philistines. And wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment, and he acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites. He defeated them. He didn't destroy them completely. And delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. Now think about that, okay? Against Moab. You don't just go into a country and defeat one city and say, we win! You have to defeat city after city after city after city. So you've got Moab, you've got Ammon, you've got Edom, you've got Zobah, now you have the Philistines. That doesn't happen in 6 months. I mean, so here is other evidence that we're talking about quite a span of time from the time that Saul began to reign until we get to this point. Now, you might be saying to yourself, okay, so what? Well, here's the important point. The important point is this. We looked at Saul last week in chapters 11, 10 and 11 and said, look at this guy. He's saved. He's being sanctified. Look at what characterizes his life. And then we come to chapter 13 and we go, what happened? What happened here? Well, that's why it's important for us, and the Spirit of God thinks it's important for us to know some of the chronology. Because we've had a number of years that have passed now, somewhere between 12 and 14, and something happened. There's a downward slide that begins to happen with King Saul, and I want to ask myself, don't you? How did that happen? What in the world brought this about? And the point that we're making here in verses 1 to 4 is that there was a slide that began to lead to a dependency upon self rather than God. Look at verse 3. You heard this read. Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." So he sends heralds out into all the towns. All Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines. Now, wait a minute. Was it Jonathan or Saul? You say, well, it was Jonathan. It said so in verse 3. Yeah, but who takes the credit for it? Saul does. You say, well, I don't know, Pastor Ike. Does that really mean that he's focused more upon himself and he's taking the glory to himself and he doesn't give it to God? Yes, absolutely. Here's why. Because next week when we look at chapter 15 and verse 12, it says that Saul built a monument to himself. He built a monument to himself. Why do you build monuments? So that everybody knows that something significant happened here and the person that's being honored was a great person. And Saul does that for himself. Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 2 says, "Let another praise you and not your own lips." Now, for as much as I like President Trump, and I even voted for him, he brags way too much about me and my administration, me and my administration. I'm thinking to myself, you know, Mr. President, let the facts speak for themselves. You don't have to toot your own horn so much. We'll pick on the others later, but we'll start there with him. But that's exactly what happens to Saul here. He begins this downward slide with a growing dependency away from God and on self in terms of what is happening in his life. Second downward spiral step in verses 5 through 8 is that he deepens this self-centeredness, and we can see it through his stewing. Verse 6 says, "When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and in pits." They're hiding out of fear. Verse 7, "And some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan in the land of Gad and Gilead, but as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling." And then verse 8 says, "Now he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come," at least not right on time. "And the people were scattering from him." Now, verse 8 says he waited for 7 days. How do you think Saul was waiting? Where is Samuel? 7 days. I mean, what's up with this? I mean, doesn't he realize that I'm the king and we need to get this show on the road? And are you speculating, Pastor Ike? No, look at verse 9. "So Saul said, 'Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offering,' and he offered the burnt offering." he is impatient. He is stewing. He is taking action into his own hands that God did not authorize him to do. The longer he waits, I think, the angrier that he gets. Now, let's shift from preaching to meddling, okay? Back on Wednesday of last week and yesterday, too, we had this discussion in our men's group about impatience. You know, it's obvious Saul is impatient here. He doesn't wait until the appointed time. And even if Samuel's a little late, give me a break. He's not that late. Samuel shows up while he's offering the sacrifice. He's not that late. But he's impatient. And so we began to ask ourselves, is impatience a sin? What do you think? We had quite a discussion about this both times. Is impatience a sin? Now, none of us, at least not me, I did not want to say yes. Okay? I don't want to say, you know, when I'm at the stoplight and I'm thinking, what is with this stoplight? Come on. It's taking forever. I don't want my wife to say, you're sinning. Even though I probably am. Or maybe I am. I remember the time when I worked at Smith Dairy, and I was glad for the job. I believe it was an answer to prayer. God, in His marvelous sovereignty, opened the doors, and even with dealing with international customers, I mean, I was pretty calm and collected. And even when things didn't go the way I wanted them to go exactly, but there was one day, I still remember this. There was one day when some things just did not go right at all, and I was so frustrated and impatient. And the ice cream sales manager said to me, I've never seen you like this. Well, that was my red flag. Okay. Okay, you're not trusting in the Lord in this situation. And really, isn't that what impatience is? It's a forgetfulness or a lack of confidence or trust in the sovereignty of God. Is God sovereign? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so all the events of my life, whatever they might be, God has orchestrated that. And if I am not happy with what He's doing in my life, the problem isn't God. Okay? The problem is me and my impatience. One of the things that we decided is that impatience is a heart issue. What do you think about that? Because we'll see as we get to on in the chapter. Verse 14, Samuel says to Saul, "But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for Himself a man after His own heart." Now, what's the implication? The implication is, Saul, you are not seeking the heart of God. And Saul, in his heart, had made the decision that he was going to do this even before Samuel had gotten there. And so we can at least say that impatience, when does impatience become sin? When we act upon it. First in our heart, and then, of course, in action. I have a question for you. Do you think that God is as interested in the means to an end as He is in the end, seeing something accomplished? Does God care how we get there? Yeah, absolutely. When we have verses like "Speak the truth in love," God says, if you're going to speak the truth, get there in a loving way. Now, that's a study in and of itself that we won't go to right now. But look at verse 11. Samuel says to Saul, what have you done? And Saul says, Samuel, I'm sorry because I disobeyed your instructions. No, not if you're following the text. He gives three excuses. I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you did not come within the appointed days. Excuse number one, people are scattering. Excuse number two, it's your fault, Samuel. And thirdly, the Philistines are assembling at Michmash. That's amazing to me. I hope you're listening. It's never right to do wrong in order to do right. That's clear here from what Saul is doing. It's never right to do wrong in order to try to do something right. In fact, Samuel calls it what? Foolish. He says, you have acted foolishly, verse 13. Impatience is foolish. Disobedience to God is acting like a fool. Now, if you don't know what fool means biblically, the word fool, if you take a concordance and look it up, it does not mean biblically that a person is intellectually deficient. It doesn't mean that. It means that a person is morally deficient, that there's a heart problem here. I think Brother Carl is the one that really likes this. The heart of the problem is the problem in the heart. Amen? Amen. That's the problem. And so through this stewing and impatience, Saul has descended down another spiral step. The third one is this. This backsliding of his continues by sedition. Now, sedition, the definition of sedition is that it is rebellion against an authority or a state. And so what Saul does is he takes matters into his own hands. He takes a role that's not given to him by God. He usurps Samuel's role as the priest by offering the sacrifice himself. Now you might say to yourself, well, now wait a minute. I thought Solomon offered sacrifices in 1 Kings 8 at the dedication of the temple. Well, yeah, he did. But I don't think he offered them himself. He offered 1,000 sacrifices. That would have taken more than a day. I mean, the Levitical priest did this under Solomon's instructions, but not Saul. He takes this authority to himself. It's very similar to King Uzziah in 2 Chronicles chapter 26 and verse 16. In 2 Chronicles chapter 26 and verse 16, it says this about Uzziah. When he became strong, his heart was so proud that he acted corruptly and unfaithfully by offering the sacrifice. And the priests come rushing in, if you read that passage in 2 Chronicles 26, and they say, what are you doing? And he says, leave me alone. You know, I'm the king. I'm paraphrasing here. And immediately he breaks out in leprosy, and they usher him out. I think God said, that's bad, leprosy. And they got him out of there. Now, can I shift again to meddling? Is that okay? How does this happen? How does a person descend? I mean, think about Saul last time. We talked about this. He's selfless. He supports others. He serves with joy. He does all. And now we have this slide into this pride and self-sufficiency and irresponsibility. What's going on here? Well, don't you think that happens with us? Okay, I know it happens with me. You know, my both hips are replaced now. I can chase Stella all around the living room. I can even catch her. And I have money in the bank. Things are just going so well. What a great thing I've done. Now, it might not be that blatant, but don't we think like that? I have health, I have money in the bank, I'm good. Boy, how could it be any better? Remember the guy I told you about last week, the Christian businessman? He gave all that money and he was on different boards. And he said, what else could the Lord give me? And somebody shouted out from the congregation, a good dose of humility. Yeah, well, that's what Saul needed too. I think oftentimes that's what we need. I mean, in verse 11, he doesn't say, you know, you're right, Samuel, I had no authority to do that whatsoever. In fact, he just makes these excuses. And what's interesting, I mentioned this already in verse 14, he says to Saul, the Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart. Saul, you are not that kind of man. Now, I don't know about you, but have you thought much about this? You mean David is a man after God's own heart? Are you serious? I mean, he lies. He commits adultery. He murders the woman's husband. He's a man after God's own heart? How is that? Well, if you contrast David and Saul, what's the difference? David repents. David listens to the prophet and says, I'm that man. We don't read that about Saul here. He doesn't do that at all. And so this downward slide, these spiral stair steps that are going down, it continues in chapter 14 and verses, I'm sorry, from verse 15 here, clear into chapter 14 and verse 23, he begins to make wrong suppositions. And now, we're not reading all the verses. Hopefully you've done that. You're familiar with the passage. But in chapter 14, you know, Jonathan and his armor bearer, they have a victory over the Philistines. The Philistines are scattering. Saul says, hey, what's going on here? What happened? Number of the people. Well, Jonathan, his armor bearer, aren't here. Oh, okay. Well, bring the ark. I mean, we're going to ask God for direction here. And so in verse 36 of chapter 14, it says, let us go down. Then Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them. And they said, do whatever seems good to you. So the priest said, let us draw near to God here. I think we should ask God first. Good idea. Verse 37, Saul inquired of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel? But God did not answer him on that day. And so what is Saul's conclusion? Verse 39, for as the Lord lives, verse 38, then Saul said, draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But not one of the people answered him. Say what? If it's in Jonathan, my son. No, time out. King, could it be you? No, couldn't be me. You see, it's a wrong supposition. Somebody must have sinned, and it's not me. It's a wrong supposition. Any kind of hypothesis or statement that is faulty is not going to stand. Okay, I'm going to go from preaching to meddling again, all right? During our mask craze in the United States, we've had people say things like, if you don't wear a mask, you don't love your neighbor. Now, don't get me wrong in light of what I'm going to say. You want to wear a mask? You wear the mask. If you don't, you don't. It's like the sign on Greenleaf Restaurant. We can't ask you, if you don't have one on, we can't ask you why, because it's against the HIPAA laws. So I like that sign. Anyhow, but when I hear, especially politicians, say, if you don't wear a mask, you don't love your neighbor. Well, now, wait a minute. Does that mean that every NFL athlete, every NBA athlete, every other person that I see exercising or doing something, or those who have exceptions, or, ready for this, the 12 states in the U.S. who don't have a mask requirement, that's of December 8th last year. Does that mean that over 20% of America doesn't love their neighbor? No, doesn't mean that at all. It's a false statement. It's a false syllogism. And Saul does the same kind of thing here. He makes an incorrect supposition. He supposes that Israel's problem isn't him. And so as a result of that, his fifth downward step is he makes a very senseless order. People in authority making senseless orders. Probably not going to connect with us, right? No. Look at verse 24 of chapter 14. Now the men of Israel were hard pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food until evening and until I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food. I don't know of any general down through history that I've read about, whether it's Patton Eisenhower or whoever it might be, who hasn't said something like, or MacArthur, an army runs on its stomach, right? And here's a king saying, if you eat anything, you're going to be cursed. Well, now, wait a minute. I mean, I remember seeing Justin Fields during the Ohio State-Clemson game eat a banana. Well, why? It's going to help him. It sure helped him during that game. It's going to help him. Well, that's true of an army as well. But, you know, Dr. Whitcomb used to say, sin is not rational. And we have that right here in King Saul as well. I wonder if we could identify any authorities in our day who make foolish orders and expect people to obey them, even though the orders are harmful to the well-being of people, or they don't do them themselves. Power corrupts, and that's exactly what's happening here with Saul as well. We've seen that, or we're going to see it in a number of examples in our country as well, because when you start doing things like that, when you start making wrong suppositions and orders that are senseless, then you have to do that by suppressing the truth. And Saul does that. We're going to see that here in verses 36 to 46. The steps downward just keep going down. And now you have to suppress the truth for self. We read verses 36 through 39. He says, even if it's Jonathan, my son. So what happens, I don't know if I should, maybe we'll just read him from verse 40. Then he said to all Israel, you shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan and my son will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. And so they cast the lots. Jonathan is taken. Saul says to him, verse 43, tell me what you've done. Jonathan said, well, I ate some honey with the end of my staff, then I guess I have to die. That's the order. And Saul says, yep, that's what's going to happen. You're going to die, Jonathan. Now, Saul really cares about Jonathan. You can see as he's weeping and pleading that this wouldn't. No, in fact, what's going to happen later? He takes a spear and tries to kill him in the chapters we're going to. I mean, think about what's happening here. His spiritual decline has affected him mentally. It's going to affect him physically as well as we go on. But the people said to Saul, verse 45, can I paraphrase this? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Jonathan is going to die. He saved us. You're going to put him to death? And so Saul, always keeping the law and not caring about how he felt, No. So the people, verse 45, rescued Jonathan. He did not die. I mean, Saul is very concerned about the polls. Whatever the polls say, that's what we're going to do. And you don't want Jonathan to die? Fine. That's not going to happen then. It's amazing how that he suppresses the truth for himself. I was really surprised. It was back in April, an article written by a CNN reporter. Can you believe that? Luke McGee, this was the title of his article. Power-hungry leaders are itching to exploit the coronavirus crisis. Think they've done that? Wow. I mean, sometime back, I emailed our governor, and I said, you know, when you say you're following the science, what about all of these references, and I gave him at least three, where there are thousands of medical professionals who don't agree with you? The response I got back was, thank you for contacting the governor. Well, I want the governor to not suppress some of the truth, right? I want him to take into account all of the facts and look at all of the facts. But that's over here. Saul is over here. And the problem is that Saul is doing this for himself. That's the problem. And the final result's going to be, we'll see that in a couple weeks, is that finally, if you continue to sidestep God's appeals to you, whether it's through the people, as the people did for Saul, whether it's through the word of God, as Samuel did for Saul, it can lead to death, physical death. That's possible, because that's exactly what happens to Saul, right? Verse 52, the end of this chapter, chapter 14, says, now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached himself to his staff. He's desperate, but God's not talking to him. Remember that? God didn't answer him. You see, when your faith is faltering, you make bad decisions. Decisions without God, decisions which lead to your own hurt and the hurt of others, decisions which hide God from your eyes and your own sin. It can be subtle. It can happen little by little, like termites eating away at the foundation of a house, unnoticed by anyone. So we need to ask ourselves, am I making decisions that have hurt myself and others? Am I not spending time praying and seeking God's face? Is there pride, the fear of what others think, impatience and irresponsibility in my life? Well, I don't want to be like Saul. Do you? I mean, he continued his course until it cost him his own life and the lives of others. There needs to be, just like there was in his life, there needs to be repentance and a renewed beginning to avoid this drifting away and to search out those unseen termites of faith that eat away at our spiritual life. Now, Gordon Weekly, I told you about him at the beginning. There came a day when he was on the street, homeless, where that deacon that I told you about went to see him and said to him, you know, you need to do what God says to get back on track with God and to follow what the Lord wants you to do. And so he did. He repented. But it didn't restore his marriage. It didn't lead him back into the pastorate. And so it's important for us to understand that we can't think like this. Oh, well, you know, if I'm like Saul and I'm sliding down, yeah, but you know, at some point I'm going to say, Lord, I'm sorry, please forgive me. It doesn't work that way because there are consequences too. The consequences of our sin, if we wait too long, the consequences may never be overcome this side of heaven. So I'm wondering, as you think about Saul this morning, have you considered there may be spiritual termites at work in your life? Maybe it's the fear of people. Maybe it's impatience. Maybe it's pride. Maybe it's irresponsibility, or it could be a combination of any of those. Well, if the Lord is speaking to you about that, don't delay. Don't delay. Get right with him today.